Now, I'll go straight into my subject, and I will point out, first of all, that in any study of this nature, we find that the true teachings of the wisdom religion have always been concealed from the masses and the majority of humanity, who would not be able to understand their true significance and importance. That which has not been understood by humanity has been preserved for us in a watered-down form, which has become myth. In fact, it's an attribute of humanity or of human mind to classify as myth that which it cannot understand. And very much of that which today is called myth is of primary importance, especially in the understanding of the wisdom religion. So we find that the wisdom religion was taught in secret in many cases, to the few. And this was the case in the mysteries of Egypt and Greece, and in the teaching in the ashram, the shelter of the guru in ancient India. The second point I want to make is that there are periods in the earth's history when the teaching of the ancient wisdom has come closer to the masses of humanity because the teachers of that ancient wisdom were both rulers in the political sense and priests in the religious sense. They were the divine kings. Especially was this the case in ancient Egypt. And thirdly, I would like to make the point that the ancient wisdom has always been available to those who seek ardently, and it will always be available to those who are willing to cast aside their preconceived ideas and make a genuine search for that which is true to them. Then we next come to the requirement to define the ancient wisdom, the wisdom religion, which our chairman spoke about. And to me, it's most important that we recognize the requirement that the wisdom religion is a direct knowledge and a recognition of the supreme importance of worlds beyond the physical, rather than the physical world of the senses, thought, and feelings. In other words, we recognize that which we know as the physical world around us and the world of our personality has its source somewhere beyond. There is something greater and bigger than that which we know. And in most religions, this has been the case. Where it has not been the case, there has been materialism. And spirituality, in any way, however we define it, under the contact of materialism, has declined. The physical world as we know it emanates from that world which is beyond. And so you get most religions the teaching of the origin or the creation of the earth. You get that in Genesis. You get it in Madame Blavatsky's secret doctrine. You get it in the teachings of the Maori. You get it in the ancient religions of India and Egypt. The second quality, or the second requirement of the ancient religion, the wisdom religion, is that it teaches that because life stems from something beyond the physical, it has a purpose, it has a plan, a divine plan. And that, of course, is the more perfect expression of all life within the world in which it manifests. Thirdly, from this comes the ethical training of the individual, and has always done when the true religion has been taught, so that the individual may live according to his own true nature, which is a spark, a separate focus of the one life, the one divine life from which all emanates. And living in accordance with that divine nature within himself, he therefore lives in accordance with the plan. He recognizes the unity of all life and of brotherhood and works within the framework of that plan for the good of all. If there is a fourth point, it's this. The wisdom religion has always been taught by symbols, by universal symbols. And I'll come back to this point later, because it's of primary importance. And because, you see, symbols are beyond the requirements or the limitations of any one language. Symbols can be and are that which is universal. Although interpreted individually, they have a quality that is universal. Now, Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the society, in The Secret Doctrine, which was her greatest works, made this remark: never was a religious founder who invented a new religion the teachers of the wisdom religion of any religion were transmitters of that truth which has always existed more than original teachers, although the manner in which they expressed their understanding of the wisdom religion varied and in that sense made it original. Now I'm going to attempt to outline the periods in the history of this earth when the ancient wisdom religion, which is embraced in modern theosophy, was most widely and powerfully influenced the lives of people, and traced the manner in which it was kept alive. During those dark times, between the periods which I mentioned, when the divine kings, the kingly priests, lived and taught on the world. Because those were the times of greatest spiritual and religious progress. I'm starting with prehistory. This is a fascinating subject. You get a little book like this, you'll get very interested in this new science, which is now finding its feet. It's not very old. Based on archaeology, of course. All prehistory is based on archaeology. A primary requirement is that there are no written records of that which is beyond in time, before in time, the written historical era, the historical era which has written records. Now, in this book on prehistory, you get the feeling, you get the knowledge that in the past man travelled much more widely than was ever believed before. And the evidence for this is growing rapidly, and even of recent years is being confirmed. Just as an example of that, within the last few years, a map was found in Yale, or was at Harvard University, a map of Vinland, V-I-N-L-A-N-D, the land of vines. Now that map has been shown to be a map of America prepared by the Vikings. There are many other instances, many other things come to light quite recently, which show that the Vikings, about the first century AD, traveled through Iceland, across to Greenland, and down to America, as well as Hudson Bay. They came down the coast here. And this is of fascinating interest. I will return later to the prehistory of the area of the British Isles. I won't deal with any prehistory as far as the Pacific is concerned tonight. Prehistory has admitted, the scientists and scholars who have studied prehistory have admitted that the civilizations of Central America here which developed to a very high degree. Around here, not a very good color, I have developed separately from the civilizations of America and North Africa, of Europe and North Africa. Now this is a very important point. It is one which scholars are now admitting. We know that the civilizations of Peru, the Mayas, the Incas of Peru, the Mayas of Mexico, and the Aztecs of that Central American era reached a very high degree of civilization. There is little to link it with the civilization of Europe, except perhaps in those symbols about which I spoke before. However, if you go to occult records, you find it recorded that this era was part, this area was part of that continent which was called Atlantis. Now, again, although at the end of last century there were many, many historians who wrote many, many books about Atlantis, all of them very good, the materialism of modern science is tending to throw Atlantis into the land of the myth. And I think it's a very great pity. It is substantiated in that which is nearest to any occult authority we can get, the secret doctrine, as much as written about Atlantis. The only historical record we have of Atlantis was given by the Greek scholar Plato, and he wrote it down, I think it's in his book about the state, the Republic. Pardon? Is it in Timaeus? Yes. Well, I'm not quite sure about that, but it did come from a man through his father, or possibly even his grandfather, from a priest in Egypt whose name was Solon. And Solon recorded that in the Atlantic there was a continent which sank. Now, he recorded that the last sinking was beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which is Gibraltar. And that was a smaller island here, which is called Posidonis. And the last sinking of that took place about 10,000 years BC, and is probably, or possibly, the story of the flood, because in sinking it caused the waters to go right across the north here. And there is a strong evidence that the Sahara at that time was a sea. There has been found, down here somewhere in Africa, the remains of a seaport. And this has been found by prehistorians, by archaeologists. So this was a sea. But let us return back again to Atlantis. The wisdom, Atlantis existed for very many hundreds of thousands of years off and on. It reached its peak perhaps about 80,000 years BC. It was a large area round in here, in the Atlantic, and probably linked Africa with South America. It is said in the occult record, and this prehistory is the occult record, that the degree of civilization reached at certain peak periods in the history of Atlantis was very high indeed, because the great giants, and remember in studying mythology that a giant isn't necessarily a person who's large in stature, but is a person who is large in mental and spiritual attainments. If you remember that as a key, it helps. The giants of Atlantis were the god kings, the divine kings who were priests and rulers. And they taught their immediate people, the more advanced people, more closest to them, a religion that was very close to that which we have defined as the ancient wisdom. They had a high degree of civilization. It said they had a sort of flying machine. They had very marvelous cities, and they had at various periods a very wonderful system of government. They were more psychic than we are today, and that anywhere there is a development, a high development of psychism, there is both the good and the bad. And the periods of good, where the religious atmosphere was pure, white magic, alternated with the periods when the black, the dark forces, in a psychic form, took control of the country. And ultimately, they developed to such an extent that they were blotted out. If you'd like to say there is a plan, the plan went wrong and they were blotted out by the sinking of that continent. Now, before that happened, a few of those who had been taught by the divine kings moved right across through here to a point in the center of Asia, in the Gobi Desert, near Lop Tor, if you look at it on the map. And that book, The Great Walk, describes that type of country very well. And there was formed the center from which the development of that race that we call the Aryan race was to take place, and did take place. Now, this is prehistory, but it's verging on history, because we do know that nearly all our civilization came to us from a point in Asia here through the language which was basic, the language of Sanskrit, and its earlier form, Senza, and that was the basis for the Latin languages of Greek and Latin itself. The teaching of the wisdom religion from this center started first of all in northern India. And I'll now take a different color because we're getting into very near that which is historical. From here, it came down into northern India. And the teaching there was given in the forms of ideographs, which are a symbol, a language of symbols, or language of symbols which substantiated or expressed an idea which was universal. And the whole of the secret doctrine is based on just that sort of ideograph, which are said to exist still today as the records from this center in the caves and secret places of Tibet and Mongolia. And these ideographs expressed the ideas of the creation of the earth. One of them is the very simple point and the circle that encloses the point as the beginning, and then you get the horizontal and the vertical cross, and then the movement of the cross as a swastika. Many, many others, but those are the basic ideographs which formed this religion. Now, very early, they became the teaching. The teaching was expressed in the Vedas of ancient India, which are the secret teachings of the Hindu religion in its very beginnings. These were transmitted orally by word of mouth. They were not written down until a later date. They do exist today. In that sense, they are historical. There are works written down of the Rig Veda and the other Vedas. But they are written down at a later date. Now you see, this has happened a lot. When we come to the study of biblical times, we find the same thing happening. Anyway, that was the beginnings of the teaching that belonged to the Aryan root race. Now, this spread down through India. But something else was happening. The remnants of the Atlanteans had traveled across Africa to Egypt. At exact what date, we don't know, because the history of Egypt starts at 5,000 years BC, but probably goes back much further. Now, I've been up the Upper Nile, and I've been to Cairo, and I had Just that feeling that which those dates that we are given are probably much more advanced, much more recent than is actually true. Tradition has it that they lived in the Nile Valley for thousands of years before the first dynasty as we know it started, the first historical dynasty. Be that as it may, it is said that the first dynasty was a mingling of the Indian civilization meeting the old Atlantean civilization in Egypt and being revitalized by it. And when that happened, of course, we reached a very high degree of spiritual attainment and spiritual teaching. Because the pharaohs were, in most instances, initiated into the mysteries. They became what we could call archbishops or high priests, as well as being temporal rulers. Many of them were psychic. Most of them, or all of them, recognized that man was one, as I said in the earlier part of my lecture, and they, in some cases, advanced beyond the attainments of later civilizations. One such was Amenhotep IV, who was known as Akhenaten, and I haven't got the name quite right. You know who I mean, Akhenaten. You know who I mean. He taught a system of politics that was the beginnings, at that early time, of internationalism. They also understood that all power came from the sun, which is the physical embodiment of that one creative source which we can call the divine. And they recognized that in man was the response to that which is the primary force, the response of the microcosm to the macrocosm. That is why Hermes taught that, or Tuhiti, as he is called in Egypt, taught that light is the beginning of all, just as Einstein has shown us more recently. And let your light shine was the motto that he gave. Man, know yourself, let your light shine, and therefore work towards that one light which is the divine by expressing the highest spiritual quality that's within yourself. Their life, their whole life, was a religious life expressed by dancing, music, and festivals on the Nile. They understood after-death conditions, and the Book of the Dead, which is extant, which does exist and has been studied, and men like Budge have translated it, does give us a very good understanding of the after-death conditions. They had the mystery schools in which many of the fundamental mysteries were taught. The after-death conditions, the emancipation of the spiritual nature of man by suffering and by what we could call the crucifixion. Now that went on, that civilization went on right up to the end of the BC period. But later, perhaps I'll come back, the last few hundred years BC, up to about 500 years BC, there was a greater contact with the rest of Asia Minor. At the same time across here, in Persia, Persian Gulf, I think it would be here, I haven't got that quite right, there was the famous Persian, it was really in those days called the Babylonian Empire. The Babylon where the Hanging Gardens were, about 4,000 years BC. And the teaching there was of the same quality as the Egyptian, or nearly the same quality, and especially was it linked with astrology, astronomy, and the beginnings of mathematics. Though the Egyptians had their own mathematics too. And we find there then this developing, and that there was even in those times a very great deal of contact between the Persians and the Egyptians. About 500 years BC was a very important date in the development and teaching of the spiritual religion, the wisdom religion. Because at that time, 500 years BC, was born into India the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, who revitalized the ancient Hindu religion about which I have taught, the religion that came from the Vedas and then the Upanishads and the Puranas, and which had as its three principal teachings the Samkhya, the Vedanta, the Samkhya, and then Yoga as Raja Yoga. Now, that teaching was not in decay, in decline, but he revitalized it and gave it its new form, which became Buddhism, and which spread rapidly. In its southern form, the Hinayana, across southern India and Southeast Asia. And the teaching there was very largely one of ethics. The threefold path and the eight noble truths. And the idea that you have to suffer and work out your personal lot in order to reach nirvana. Still strong in the world and started 2,500 years ago. In its northern aspect, it was more mystical. It, from Tibet, spread to China and Japan, and in Japan became Zen Buddhism, the most mystical of all. There you are told to empty your mind, which is Raja Yoga again, and to realize that in the void there is supreme spiritual significance. And that Zen Buddhism is very interesting. It's interesting many Western people in the world today. So we have Buddhism, one of the great religions, and certainly one that taught the ancient wisdom. The mechanics of the ancient wisdom are things like what we call reincarnation, that you will be born again and work out your life again in a fresh body because you are the spiritual entity and not the vehicles through which you express life. That was part and parcel of the Eastern world. It was part and parcel of the Egyptian teaching. It is part and parcel of the Buddhist teaching. Now, at the same time, over in China, lived Confucius and Lao Tzu, again teaching a form of the wisdom religion, which we haven't time to go into tonight. But the more important one to us was here in the little island off the coast of Turkey, which is Samos, where was born Pythagoras, as I have always called him, but whose correct name, I believe, is Pythagoras. He was the first of the Western philosophers, and he learned from the mystery schools of Egypt and traveled there. He learned from the mystery schools and teachings of the Levant, and even, it is said, reached India. And he started the whole of the religious life, the religious understanding of the Western world today. And the more you study this, the more you find that he was the one who gave us the teaching even of the Christian Bible. Now, this is most interesting indeed. Now, in Samos, from Samos, he traveled and spent a long time in Egypt and that Tyre on the coast of the Levant. And ultimately, he set up his school, because he couldn't in Samos, where he was born, in Sicily, where he taught. And he taught his disciples in a secret way,
So that it is no longer recorded exactly what he taught. But the tradition is that he taught them the one life, that there is one life, and that its energy, its primary energy, he called heat. But he meant what Einstein said, that there is one energy and one only. He explained that mathematics, in all its forms, was the basis for the manifestation of the universe, or the solar system, if you like to stick to the lesser rather than the greater. And primarily, that was his reason for teaching mathematics. He also started Western music, the five-note scale, which is the basis of today's music, because he understood that sound also was a primary factor in the creation of understanding the nature of the manifested world. In his school, a strict vegetarian diet and a very strict periods of meditation, the review at night before you went to sleep, all these were parts of the curriculum within his school. He taught that there were three parts to the human activity, human principle, the nous, the something or other, and the something or other. The nous is that which is the spiritual or divine essence, which is immortal. The other are the physical personality of thought and feeling, the personality of thought and feeling, and the physical activity of the nervous system and the body. And this idea was of primary importance. It was taken by Plato, who followed and was his pupil, and in many ways expanded. It was taken and believed in by Aristotle, who went into the realms of logic and set the pattern for Western thought as against Eastern, with its forms of logic. Now, all that happened about 600 AD. And about that time, I believe, Moses, who lived about the time of Akhenaten in Egypt, moved out of Egypt up into Palestine and took with him the Hebraic ancient religion, which is today kept in the Kabbalah and which is a form of the teachings of early Egypt. That was taken up into Palestine and Asia Minor by the Jews, and the Mosaic Law became the basis of most of those pre-Christian teachings. It was taught in the secret schools of the Essenes and many other communities in that part of the world. Its language was Aramaic, and that's important because Aramaic was one of the first languages in which the apostles wrote, or the records of the apostles, the codex as they are called, were written, which formed the basis for the Bible. The Bible is basically Jewish, but influenced tremendously by Greek thought. The two at that time were one. And the Greek system of thinking spread right across here and ultimately into the Arab world. So I'm getting a little ahead of myself there. Now, it's very difficult to find out exactly what did happen when the Bible was written. And I haven't gone far enough into this study to say very much. But it is primarily the secret teaching of the Jewish faith that is recorded in the esoteric aspects of the Bible. Its history as well, but it's mostly the secret teaching in the Bible is the Jewish form. Now, we have a history of this period written down by Josephus. We have a copy of his book here. And we have other recorded histories of these years. But there is a certain amount of fog, as it were, about the first century AD from a historical point of view. But we have something else happening that is very important. 300 years BC, Alexander the Great went right across and conquered the whole of Arabia and down into India. Now, in those days, the traffic to India was down the coast here and across through Afghanistan and Khyber Pass, and down that way through Baluchistan. And Bactria was the chief town where the caravans met. Most interesting that there are those two routes in. And the Indian trade used to go up the coast of India here, and spices and all the rest of the things were transshipped into or moved from boats to caravans, and then up here or by sea up here, and then by caravan across here to the Mediterranean. And that interplay went on all the time. Although there are not many historical records of these voyages and these journeys, because nearly all one came from that and then the other took over and carried on. But the interplay of culture was there. And Buddhism itself moved up here and touched the Arab world in those early centuries BC, in those first few centuries BC. Well, then Alexander the Great conquered right across here in Mesopotamia and touched, as we said, the influence of the Eastern world. He himself was not a spiritual teacher, but he helped connect the whole. And at Alexandria in Egypt was founded a new city, which was to become the meeting place of all the cultures of the world at that time. The first was Philo, the first philosophical teacher there was called Philo the Jew, Judea. And you'll find, I think, in Mr. Hodgson's second volume of The Secret Mystery of the Hidden Wisdom in the Holy Bible, he has, for a very interesting reason, I think, dedicated that book to Philo, the first teacher of Alexandria. 20 years BC he lived. But in the early centuries AD, this was where all the manuscripts came, where all the teachers lived, and it was the spiritual center of the world. Although, of course, the center was going on in India, just the same, but this was where, if you might say, the importance moved. All because of Pythagoras, who set it going. The first great teacher was Ammonius Saccas, who was of Christian parents, but became that very thin line in those days between a Christian and one who was called a pagan. There was a very thin line, and he went from Christian parents and became the supreme teacher of the ancient wisdom, which was based on the Jewish and based on the Egyptian. And its normal translation, normal expression, was through the Greek language. There were many others lived about that time and taught that which is the nearest we have, which is the beginning of modern theosophy. Iamblichus, who wrote a history of Pythagoras, there was another one written by Porphyry, who was the disciple of Plotinus, whom Dean Ing in these days has written about his mystical form of Christianity. And the greatest possibly was Origen, who was a bishop of the Christian Church. And his book, De Principis, exists today in part anyway, and can be read. And I think I could quote from that. Theosophia which was the teaching of Alexandria, and the Neoplatonists, as they were called, had these 3 points as its basic teaching. There is one absolute existence, an infinite essence, which is the source of everything. In this, everything lives and moves and has its being. This essence, or being, is contained within man, is the real man, and in nature also, and represents in man his divine potentiality. It is thus matter as well as that life which is within matter. What more could you have than a perfect definition of that which I tried to explain earlier? There is a divine task or plan by which this inner divinity becomes revealed in the human being, which is the more perfect expression which we can call evolution. And if you read Origen or Plotinus, you will find that all that is taught as Theosophia. And that's where the word comes from. In the first 4 centuries A.D. Most of it in the 2nd and 3rd centuries A.D. And in 391 A.D., that great catastrophe occurred when the forces were closing in and the whole of the Alexandrian library, with all these marvelous and precious manuscripts, 200,000 of them, was burnt. And then a few years later, Hypatia, who was a teacher, who was a daughter of a philosopher, especially a mathematician, and who herself was a pagan, but a student of Theosophia and a mathematician in her own right, was murdered by a Christian mob, 419 AD. And from then on, the political aspect of the Christian Church closed in on Theosophia, and we got the denial of the truths of Theosophia. It started much centuries earlier. I've just read a book about the various conclaves of bishops. Now remember, Origen himself was a bishop of the Christian Church. And about 500 years AD, I think it was at Constantinople, his teachings were declared heretical. And from then on, the process started by which all these teachings, including the teaching of reincarnation, were pushed underground. And the petty little squabbles that have been going on since that time between different sects, the Nestorians and the Philistites and various others throughout the whole of this world, including the Greek Church as well, the Orthodox Greek Church, which moved across to Lebanon, they were going on all the time, these squabbles, and the true teaching was lost. Reincarnation was taught by Pythagoras, not really as metempsychosis or as transmigration of souls, which was interpreted by the Christian people as meaning that a person would be that which is the divine element, or the reincarnating principle in a human being, would return as the divine element in an animal's body. And that was never taught by Pythagoras. The Christian world, in its revolt against the true teachings of the Neoplatonic world and the early Christian fathers, used this as a method, as one writer says, to bring disrepute upon the teachings of the great early Christians who based their teachings on Pythagoras. And again, he was thrown into disrepute, the greatest of all. But you know, it has been said, and is historically appreciated, that this which went on at this time gave us the basis for Christian thought and that basis was largely Greek, because in Alexandria it met the melting pot, as it were, and all its expressions were Greek. The Christian teachings were translated not only into from Aramaic into Greek, but also into the Arabic languages in the early centuries up to 5-6 AD, and they are very useful because so many of the Greek texts were destroyed, but the Arabian texts existed. Now the Arabians were interested because, you see, it's interesting to find the part the Arabs played in this, because with the decline of the Roman Empire, and the Romans were great road builders, but they were not great in the sense of either spreading or understanding the wisdom religion. And when the empire declined, there was the beginning of that dark period in European history when the secret science went underground. Now the Arabs, having learnt something of these truths through the Greeks, carried it right through down up here to Algeria, and the Moors, moving into Spain in the early centuries, brought with them their knowledge of Greek science and religion and religious thought, and it blossomed forth in Spain and then into Italy and became the basis of the Renaissance. That's most interesting. That was how it was retained. So much I haven't touched upon. Time is getting on. I just want briefly to tell you how this wisdom religion was retained and kept alive during those early centuries. We start, I think, with the troubadours. They knew something of the teachings, and going from court to court, they, in their little rhymes and their songs and their poetry, taught the truths of the wisdom religion. And most of those are kept in memory for us today in the fairy stories that we know. The kiss of the Prince Charming is always the kiss of the higher spiritual nature of man, awakening within the personality his spiritual understanding. The Hansel and Gretel, where they dropped the crumbs, and the witch in the sugar candy house is the enmeshment of the spiritual nature in the world of matter, and the crumbs are that which leads the true nature of man through the forest back to that which is spiritual freedom. And so you go on. Just exactly as the same way the Greek myths contain the same ideas, but I can't go into that tonight. So the troubadours kept it alive. The alchemists kept it alive, because the same idea was there in all alchemy, not transmuting a base metal into gold. That's the blind. That which was being transmuted was the nature of man, the ordinary nature of man, into a spiritual nature, or the bringing out or the expressing of the spiritual nature of man. We have the saints living right through, and beautiful books and mysticism like the Cloud of Unknowing. We have St. John of the Cross and various other Christian saints who had some knowledge of, through meditation and other form and other activities, of the true nature of things and the nature of man in relation to the divine. Then about 1100 AD we had an interesting movement. We had the Crusades. The Crusades were a stupendous undertaking that it's very, very difficult to us to understand. All these men, knights, and all their retainers and bishops and all the clergy took part. And they went in thousands from England through and collected all the Germans and the French noblemen, and right across here through Romania and down through Turkey, building forts as they went and keeping themselves alive in a very inhospitable, mountainous country, Turkey is, and building forts right down the backbone of Palestine until ultimately they did, for a short time, capture and control Jerusalem. But in doing so, they were affected by the Oriental or the Eastern religious teachings, and the Bible came alive to them, especially in the Hebrew teachings. And from then on, we got the beginnings of a underground, through Masonry and through the Rosicrucians and various other movements, we got the beginnings of an underground forms of activity which were spreading, reviving again the ancient mysteries and the secret teachings. Christian Rosenkreuz started the Rosicrucians. There were others, men like Roger Bacon, Francis Bacon, and later on Sir Thomas More, whose picture you saw, and various others who have kept that flame alive through the centuries. But it wasn't, I suppose, until 1875 when Madame Blavatsky founded this society, that all those teachings which in the early days were secret, although it is said that Origen himself, when he went to Rome, did make public and did write down that which he had been taught and he had been asked to keep secret. However, be that as it may, it was in 1875 when the society was founded that the world was given access to these teachings. And now we see what the world is doing to us. I don't think I could say any more. There's all sorts of things I haven't got around to. I want to say something about the Druids and the prehistoric past and continent. Perhaps we should keep that some other time. I think I can only close on that thought that that which was in the past kept secret has now been made available to us. And it is up to the Western world to use this knowledge to the advantage of the whole world.